Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How different would the world be if William Shakespeare had never put pen to paper? Of course, we can frame that question in terms of his magnificent artistic contributions, but as my guest today will tell us, Shakespeare has had an impact on life in every corner of the English-speaking world and far beyond it, even on those who might never see one of his plays or read a single sonnet. Stephen Marsh is a novelist and culture columnist for Esquire, and before that he was professor of Renaissance drama at City College of New York. His new book, now out in paperback, is called How Shakespeare Changed Everything. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Please, pleasure to be here.
So the most remarkable thing about Shakespeare's influence is the degree to which it extends beyond the point that we even realize that we are being influenced by Shakespeare. We don't even have to know Shakespeare to be affected by his work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what I was trying to get at in this book is, you know, you sort of ask, I'd come to writing novels and writing articles and so on, and I sort of asked myself as I reach my early 30s, like, what does this do in the world? Like, what effect does this actually have on people? And most of the answers I found were pretty, you know, airy-fairy, pretty moves people's souls and so on, and they're all true. I just wanted to find out what the material changes that someone like Shakespeare had on the world, and I found them pretty shockingly general, actually.
Did that send you back to writing novels? Like, okay, this is worth it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, the one thing it makes pretty clear is that, you know, while Shakespeare has this huge influence, on the other hand, you know, he could never have imagined what effect his work would have.
Yeah.
You know, he could never have imagined that he would have been involved in the assassination of Lincoln, because he never could have imagined the United States, or Lincoln, or a civil war, or so on. So, you know, as he says in the middle of Hamlet, you know, our thoughts are ours, their ends none of their own. That is sort of what I took back to writing, that idea.
So let's talk about the assassination of Lincoln. Many people may not know that John Wilkes Booth was the brother and the son of really well-respected Shakespearean actors.
Yes, I mean, his father, Lucius Brutus Booth, remember that name, is the, you know, he was the greatest Shakespearean actor of his time, and he was so successful as an actor that he was able to, that all of his sons were able to have careers as Shakespearean actors based on their names. And so they actually sort of broke up into different regions of the country. So John Wilkes took the South, and he was born in Maryland, and he was very much a Southerner. And then Edwin Booth, who I would consider the greatest actor of his generation, probably maybe the greatest Hamlet ever, and who invented a lot of the way we think of modern performances of Shakespeare heroes. He was a Northerner, and he was a profound patriot, so much so that when his wife was giving birth to their son in London, in England, he actually draped the Stars and Stripes over her knees so that the son would be born under the American flag. And so they were very, very divided by the politics of the era, like many families, of course, and to this day. And they got together, you know, about 6 months before Lincoln was assassinated in order to put on a performance of Shakespeare to raise money for his statue in Central Park. And, you know, that, I think, was a hugely important moment for everyone in that family.
And if John Wilkes Booth had not been such an abysmal actor himself, he might never have been driven to commit the most notorious crime in American history.
Well, he wasn't a bad actor. He was a fine actor. I mean, he was certainly a bad man. And, you know, although, you know, of all the people planning the conspiracy to assassinate Lincoln, he was the only one with any guts in the whole crew. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I guess, depends on how you see it. But, you know, I mean, the thing was that he was very much inspired by Shakespeare. I mean, profoundly inspired by Shakespeare. You know, when he was on the run from the federal marshals, he actually wrote in his diary, "I'm being pursued over hill and country for doing what Brutus did." And when the way that he killed Lincoln in a theater, he shoots Lincoln, he jumps on stage, he shouts out "Sic semper tyrannis," which means "Thus ever to tyrants," and is the motto from the seal of the state of Virginia, speaking in Latin at the moment of assassination, just as Julius Caesar speaks in Latin at the moment of assassination in Julius Caesar. You know, clearly that play, which he'd just performed with his brother in New York a few months earlier, inspired the whole scenery of how he committed this murder.
Another thing that I did not realize before reading your book, and this is really chilling, is that days before he was shot, Lincoln spent a fair amount of time reading Shakespeare aloud, specifically Macbeth.
Yeah, he was going down the Potomac with Charles Sumner, and Sumner was really a ball breaker. Like he'd wanted something from Lincoln, and he was constantly nagging him. And so basically the way Lincoln got around it is said, why don't we read Shakespeare together? And so they read Macbeth, and Lincoln actually read the passage where Shakespeare invented the word assassination, which I think is just the strangest kind of coincidence. But, you know, this book is essentially a collection of these bizarre coincidences of Shakespeare being involved at these key moments in history.
So invented the word assassination and more than 1,700 other words. It's astonishing to think of a single person coining that many words that lasted. Why did he make them up? Were there not enough good words for him to use?
Well, you know, it is a really crazy number, 1,700 words. I mean, it really, really dwarfs everything, every other writer in any other language. You know, it should be clear, like, lexicography is a very imprecise science, and we don't really know, like, it could have been that Shakespeare heard this word on the street all the time, and he's just the first person to mention it in something written down.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, he probably invented hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of words, and they're very common words, like bandit, alligator, academe, skim milk, you know, to dawn as a verb, never before used before Shakespeare, to elbow out of the way as a verb. And that's in addition to, like, you know, hundreds of expressions that we use all the time, the be-all and the end-all. Snail's pace, green with envy. You know, literally I have like 3 pages in the book where it's just a list of all of these expressions. You know, he was the great pyrotechnician of words. You know, I mean, his language was his special effects. And so I think he was the great inventor of language anywhere.
And all these phrases, you know, bag and baggage and green with envy, I suppose they stayed with us because they work so beautifully. We know exactly what they mean when we hear them.
Yeah, I mean, there is, like, you know, part of this is historical. You know, he had the British Empire as a way of imposing his work. And there are, like, there is a certain measure of historical accident to why he became so successful. But, you know, I mean, the one that really blew my mind was the name Jessica.
Mm.
You know, nobody names their daughter Jessica because it's Shakespearean, or, you know, it sounds grand or something like that, like it's a literary allusion. They name their daughters Jessica because it sounds like a really good name.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with that, and he was capable of doing that in a whole range of ways, you know.
And I suppose people, I mean, it took a while for us to think of Shakespeare as we do today. He was very famous in his own time, but he wasn't necessarily thought of as sort of superhuman.
Well, he was in his own lifetime, he was known to be a great man. I mean, everyone knew that he was the best at his profession, but his profession was pretty low down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's sort of like being, you know, how many television writers do we know now? You know, maybe 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
He might have been of those 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he certainly, like, what happened was that then the British Empire happened, and they needed a kind of icon of Britishness, and they completely transformed him. They, first of all, they cut virtually all the sex from of which there's, you know, everything from his work. And then, you know, they made it the standard of their education system. So when you went to India, when you went to the West Indies, when you went to America, you know, Shakespeare was this icon of civilization. He got turned into that pretty quickly.
A word that Shakespeare didn't give us but that we have because of him is Baudelaireize.
Yes. I mean, you know, the thing that's interesting about Baudelaire is that, you know, they're given this reputation as cutting, as these great cutters of things. But the thing you have to understand is, like, actually what they were doing was making a version of Shakespeare that was something similar to his work that could be read in polite society, you know? That they could, and incidentally, they didn't put Othello in their book at all because there was no way that they could make it work for family reading. When you look at what was actually performed in, you know, the 18th century of Shakespeare's work, it amounts to about two-thirds of his words. You know, people were, theater directors were very practical about these things. If they want to give Hamlet a happy ending, they just go ahead and do it. You know, I mean, they don't, if they think that's going to sell, that's what they did. And so actually the Bowdlers were right at the beginning of a movement to actually try and figure out what Shakespeare wrote and what constitutes his actual work, which is where we're at today. I mean, no director alive is so avant-garde that they're going to turn Romeo and Juliet into a comedy. Mm-hmm. But that was done all the time.
Well, there's Gnomeo and Juliet, but that's another story.
That's true. I didn't think of that. That's a good example. Although that's not avant-garde, is it?
No.
But
you know, what's interesting is that, so we're not still changing the endings, we're not changing maybe the fundamental messages of these works, but it's extremely common for directors to play with language because they're not sure the 21st century audience will understand some of this language.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I really believe, this is an academic's take on it, but I kind of think there are two versions of Shakespeare plays, ones where the audience can understand what they're saying and ones where the audience can't understand what they're saying, and people like the former and dislike the latter. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it is a hard job being a Shakespearean actor. It requires a lot of skill. But on the other hand, you know, I think you have to recognize that in Shakespeare's day, because he was inventing so many words, you know, by some accounts, something like 10% of the words in his plays, they were fantastic expressions, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were not, it was not like you went down the street and people were talking like, to be or not to be, that's the question. Right? I mean, it was already a kind of elaboration of the language.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think, you know, time is not as huge a disadvantage as it might seem.
You also identify a couple of words that you and other scholars continue to struggle to figure out what in the world they might mean.
I know, it's great. There's two, right?
Yeah.
Prenzie.
P-R-E-N-Z-I-E, is that right?
Which nobody knows what it means. It's used three times.
Mm-hmm.
So it must have meant something to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it wasn't a typo error or something like that. You know, so there's several conjectures, princely, things like that. The other one is great. It's from The Tempest, and it's one of the words from Taliban, his speech, and it's scammels. And some people think it's a typographer's error, and it could be like sea muse, which was a kind of like seagull. Or it could be, you know, it could be something we don't know about, or it could, you know, my supervisor's favorite idea was that it was a word that Shakespeare gave just to Caliban, so only he would know it.
Like it's a magical word.
Like, yeah, or it's, you know, it's his, because, you know, you've given me a tongue. Maybe this was the one thing that he had that they didn't have, you know.
Stephen Marsh is with us. He's a novelist and culture columnist for Esquire. His book, which is now out in paperback, is called How Shakespeare Changed Everything. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or the email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Stephen Marsh is my guest this hour. He's formerly a professor of Renaissance drama at City College of New York. He now earns his living as a novelist and culture columnist for Esquire. And he's got a book of nonfiction called How Shakespeare Changed Everything, which has just been released in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So in terms of Shakespeare's reach into contemporary race relations, you tell us that for a long time, the biggest problem people had with this was that for their taste, Shakespeare was not racist enough.
Yes. I mean, with the story of Othello, like its reception is absolutely, I mean, it's just fascinating to me because it's so complicated. I mean, usually when you think of you know, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, or something like that, and, you know, they say something like the word Negro, which they don't mean at all racistly, but you think of it as racist. That's the kind of normal way that time deals with race. But the way Shakespeare works is that he was a very profoundly racist author, I believe, certainly anti-Semitic, and also, I think, in the play Othello, he can't, like, the only way it makes sense is if the character's blackness is inherently some kind of barbarism that needs to be overcome by Christian Venice, you know, and so on. Now, that to me is how the play was originally written. But then what happened in history is that because it had a love story between a black man and a white woman, because it had a noble black character who's, you know, probably the most eloquent character in all of Shakespeare, I would say, and is also the absolute paragon of gentlemanliness, of the Renaissance ideal of gentlemanliness, the play becomes this anti-racist tool, particularly in the hands of Paul Robeson, who, you know, it had the longest run in history on Broadway for its time, and then he toured it all over America. And, you know, he would get booed, and there were all these incidents in hotels, and it was a great struggle. But he said, you know, Othello has made me free, which is just a profoundly strange idea when you think of the original intent of the play.
And talk about Paul Robeson for those who haven't heard of him before.
Oh, Paul Robeson was sort of the great, a great actor of the 1920s and 30s. He sang a lot of songs that he made famous, particularly through Showboat. I think that was probably his biggest hit. He was also, he used his fame almost immediately for major political reasons. He was the first black man who was able to speak to Major League Baseball about desegregating baseball. He supported a lot of, he got a communist alderman elected in Harlem, basically on the strength of his personality. He was eventually played the sort of ultimate compliment by the FBI, and was blackballed from every venue that he could do, and his income just totally disappeared. But he was sort of a hero in many ways, and one of the ways was that he became truly a great Shakespearean actor and really made Othello something that had never been before.
And his personal life was on display as his fame grew as well. Can you talk about how fans and others reacted to that?
Well, yes. I mean, he you know, he was touring this play, which, you know, a lot of certainly in the pre-war South, for instance, Othello gets less and less black every year as it's performed. It was a favorite play in the pre-war South, but basically they could not tolerate a black man with a white woman in a bedroom on a stage. They just couldn't deal with it. And so that, therefore, you have the Age of Bronze Othellos, where they basically make him look sort of more Muslim from the Middle East rather than a Moor from West Africa. And so, you know, so as he's, you know, when Robeson does Othello, he makes it very, very African, and he really plays up that strongly, and that's the source of its power, really, and that's why it was so shocking to audiences in 1930 in Britain and then in the 40s in America. At the same time, he's dating Uta Hagen, who is his Desdemona, but at the same time is married to the guy playing Iago. So it's this it's a cluster. It's a cluster problem of relationships. Typical actor stuff. They're on tour and they're all sleeping around. But you know, things would happen. Like he would be in an elevator. He'd be standing beside Uta Hagg, and the door would open. A white woman would see them, spit in her face, and walk away. But the stories like that, there are 100 stories like that. I mean, you know, he would go into restaurants and people would say, oh, my name's Robeson too. My grandfather probably owned you. Things like this. And, you know, his tour as he went through America is this kind of, confrontation of racism. You know, I mean, he goes to hotels and they say, I'm sorry, you've booked a room? They take him to the back room where the offices are, and there's a cot behind the offices. So he decides to sleep in it. It's sort of this kind of really pretty heroic story because he did it for years, and it just sounds absolutely unbearable.
And to be sure, it would be a dotted line, but you do think it's possible to draw a line between Robeson's Othello and a President Barack Obama?
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, we're amazingly, the birther conspiracy has not gone away. You know, it is absolutely fascinating how to me anyway, how the narratives that are prepared for us have this incredible kind of way of residing and residually staying there. I mean, the thing about Othello is you have this narrative of an African sort of both outside and inside of a white culture who comes to the aid of the Republic at its moment of most extreme failure and does so triumphantly through rhetoric. I mean, does that sound familiar? it is a prepared narrative that has been residing in American life for 200 years and longer.
Talk about how Shakespeare influenced our ideas about sex.
Well, I think he is the single most influential thinker or writer of any kind about sex that we have in our time, right now. Because, I mean, the simple truth is when you read Shakespeare, there is a kind of total omnivorous sexuality. Everything's mentioned in it. Lesbianism, homosexuality, he himself was probably bisexual. There's the lust of 13-year-old girls, there's horny old men, there's everything. You know, the entire realm of sexuality is described. What happened is that once he became an icon, he immediately had to be desexualized by culture. And so, you know, whereas Dante, a guy who was married his whole life and had one sort of moment of longing for a 13-year-old girl on a bridge in Italy, is turned into this icon of the Latin lover, the sexual icon of lust. Shakespeare, who lived on the south side of London, which was, you know, where the brothels were and, you know, had slept around and probably slept with men and, you know, slept with everything, basically, he gets turned into an English butcher, you know? He gets turned into like a craftsman, something like that. This happens to the works where all the sex is cut out, so that by the time you reach Freud, you can't really find sex in Shakespeare unless you know where to look. And what I would say is that what Freud did is that he took the frank sexuality in Shakespeare, which you find in works like Hamlet and which are the basis of concepts like transference and repression and the Oedipal complex. He took the very frankness about sexuality and made it, rather than being a moral problem, it's just a human problem. It's just a problem of the material life of having a human body. That, I think, is the root of our own, you know, the sort of lesser sexual revolution that we're going on to now, where sex really isn't considered a moral issue, but a personal choice. That idea is really, you know, the place where you find that most carefully, fully worked out is in Shakespeare. And, it comes through Freud, but ultimately it goes back to him.
And there's automatically a sort of layer of comfort with gender bending required based on the fact that in Shakespeare's day, there were no women on the stage. It was men playing women.
Yes, which is, when you consider that, I would say almost all of the great parts for women that you find on the classical stage come from him. Just one amazing women's part after another for 36 plays is pretty shocking. Shakespeare was performing. When you go to a Shakespeare festival and it's all very nice and there are rose gardens everywhere, and then you go and have little tea and it all seems very genteel, this is not how Shakespeare was originally performed.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally performed in the South Bank of London, which is where the brothels were, where the dogfights were. So, Shakespeare was competing with bear baiting. Should we go and see As You Like It today, or should we go and see six bulldogs try and kill a bear?
Yeah.
He's got to compete with that kind of fun. what I mean? That kind of bloody fun.
Yeah.
And so he came from a very materialistic, very kind of sketchy world. That's where those plays emerge from.
Is there anything wrong with the fact that Shakespeare was very happy to get lots of money to make the plays that he did?
No, he was not the kind of guy you wanted as a business partner. When his friend decided, when they were in negotiations about the Globe, he said, I'm going to move, and he moved it overnight to the South Bank
mm-hmm.
before the guy could really get his what was due to him. He was a he wanted money, and he wanted the status that now seems to us ridiculous. Like, he wanted a title in Stratford upon Avon. He wanted those little things. I think that's the way writers always been, probably always will be.
So you mentioned title. There are people, and this is going to, I'll go ahead and raise your ire now. There are people who say, well, he had a title because he was the Earl of Oxford. Talk about why this theory makes you crazy.
Well, yeah, I wrote about this for The Times when that movie Anonymous came out. I'll just give you the most easy argument,
mm-hmm.
which is that Edward de Vere died in 1604,
mm-hmm.
and Shakespeare kept writing until about 1613. And most of the time, or not most of the time, but several times with partners. And also he makes reference to things that have just happened in 1605 and 1609. So the Edward de Vere argument, it's not that it's unlikely true. It's totally impossible. It's really on the level of moon landing, conspiracy theories, aliens built the pyramids kind of stuff. So intellectually it has absolutely no credibility whatsoever. The real thing but that's not really what irritates me about it. What irritates me about it is this idea that the only people who can write are lords.
Hmm.
Because first of all, that flies in the face of all evidence. John Keats spoke in a Cockney accent. Charles Dickens was a bootblacker as a kid. Literature, particularly from England, tends to be made by the middle classes. In America now, too, it's still, it's not a lot of, you don't see a lot of centimillionaire, billionaires kids writing novels. It's more people from regular walks of life that tend to be writers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the snobbery that really, really annoys me.
Why do you think people persist in hanging on to that? It's not that everybody wants to elevate the wealthy and the powerful, is it?
No, I think, one thing is that we don't really know a lot about Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't. He wrote his, he signed his name six times in his lifetime, and he signed it each time differently, with different spelling. So, we don't really know how he spelt his name. We don't know the day of his birth. We don't really know how old he was when he died. We don't know. There's so much that we don't know. There's this idea that his wife was 7 years older than him, but that's based on really one very weak piece of evidence. We don't really know what his domestic life was like. We don't really know anything about him. And we live in a time where, and we have for since the Romantic period, where we think of authors as these gods that compose things, and therefore, when we read their works, we're in communion with them.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare doesn't really offer that. And so I think it's this attempt to fill in that blank by making stuff up.
When you say weak piece of evidence, that's her tombstone, though, right? Were they often wrong?
Yes.
Really?
All the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally all the time. I mean, it would really not be shocking for her gravestone to be wrong.
Huh.
All of these pieces of evidence are very, very weak. We don't, you know, the record-keeping in 16th, 17th century England, it's not like today, where everything you do leaves some kind of trace. I mean, we really don't know much about him except one law thing in his will, and then the plays, which are themselves very often have multiple versions, and we're not sure exactly what he intended.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very complicated trying to figure out who he was.
Just for my curiosity, I've always wondered about the spelling issue, because it does seem odd that someone who was so meticulous with language would not have standardized for himself the way he signed his own name.
I don't know. you're right. Like, it does seem weird. And, you know, the thing that makes it even more frustrating is that there was applicable orthography then, so there is a connection between the way things are spelled and the way things sound.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really know how his name sounded.
Wow.
You know, it could have been Shakespeare, right? I mean, we don't really know that. Yeah, why he was so careless with his name. However, I will say he was completely careless with his plays.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, there are 9 existent versions of Richard III, all of which have a legitimate claim to be, the one that he intended. Hamlet exists in 3 versions, which are very different, and which, you know, scholars spend their lives trying to fit together into some kind of structure. So, you know, I think the thing you have to remember is that for him, he was a theater maker.
Hmm.
Right? I mean, he was involved in making plays that were performed, and then when they were done, it was like, well, I mean, why should I write down Macbeth? I'm not going to get any money for it.
Yeah.
You know, let's go on to, you know, write Othello.
Stephen Marsh is with us. We are talking about his book, How Shakespeare Changed Everything, which is now available in a paperback edition. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or the email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Marsh. He's a novelist and culture columnist for Esquire, formerly a professor of Renaissance drama at City College of New York. We're talking about his book, How Shakespeare Changed Everything, which is now available in paperback. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, yeah, I just had a question. The author had suggested a moment ago that Shakespeare might have been bisexual or homosexual, and he also said that there's still a lot about him that we really don't know. So I'm just curious, where he would get that idea.
Thanks for your call.
Well, the short answer is the sonnets, because there are these sort of very erotic love poems to a young man. That's the long answer too. The long answer, I guess, is that scholars have assumed from the basis of that he had some kind of homoerotic content in his life. But you know, his biography is very shallow. That is, we are drawing that from those poems.
We can't say exactly that Shakespeare invented adolescence, but he certainly identified it and defined it in a way that hadn't been done before. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, when I say in the book, like, this is that Shakespeare invented teenagers, it sort of seems crazy, like I'm saying he invented the spring or something like that. But, you know, I mean, in the medieval period, there really was a very sharp line between childhood and adulthood, so that it's sort of like a bar mitzvah. You know, I mean, before you were a kid, today you're a man or a woman. In Romeo and Juliet, what you find is exactly all of the problems that we still have with adolescence. And he does it so early, and he does it so thoroughly that, you know, that conception of adolescence has remained basically intact from Romeo and Juliet to today. So, for example, you know, the whole question of how young is too young to start having sex. Juliet, at the beginning of the play, is 13, which, you know, unless you're a Polish film director, is probably too young to start a love affair. There's also these kind of violent gangs of kids roaming the streets of Verona, which are very recognizable. The whole issue of, you know, when Georgia and Florida and one other state that slips my mind, they changed their statutory rape laws so that when somebody who was 16 had sex with somebody who was 14, it didn't count as rape. And they called those the Romeo and Juliet provisions. This play really has defined adolescence for 400 years.
And even Hamlet, in this era of the 25-year-old still living with mom and dad, strikes you as a sort of adolescent figure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, his age is, of course, a very difficult question, how old he is, and because there seems to be there are technical mistakes in the play about his age and when he was at university and so on. Usually he's played in his mid-30s. Ophelia, on the other hand, is probably one of the great adolescent characters, as from Reviving Ophelia, the hit book from, you know, the 1990s, where you have someone with so much social pressure on them that essentially, as an adolescent, that essentially they can't bear it. I would say Hamlet is one of the great plays of adolescence as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Gwen in Dallas. Hey, Gwen.
Hi there. Well, this is rather a boring question after
surely
sex
not.
And passion and adolescent angst. But I was just interested to know about different translations internationally. I know that in Germany, people are very proud of the translations by Schiller, and I got the impression that's considered one of the, you know, great literary treasures of Germany. And I just wonder, are there any languages that have particularly good or not good translations?
That's not a boring question at all, because, I mean, one of the things that is so fascinating about Shakespeare is that he's probably more popular outside the English-speaking world than he is inside it. I mean, the Schiller translation of it is considered a masterpiece, but the Germans really, you know, they consider it sort of an accident that Shakespeare happened to have been born in England.
Like he should have been German.
A Germanic writer. you know, in fact, the Nazis were crazy about Shakespeare and made, you know, they had more performances of Shakespeare in Germany in 1936 than in the rest of the world combined.
But not the Merchant of Venice.
Because the play violated the Nuremberg laws. Romania has a particularly strong attraction to Romeo and Juliet, for instance, because performing Shakespeare meant that they were Western and belonged to Western Europe rather than to Turkey and to, you know, the Ottoman Empire. In the 19th century, I mean, he was easily the most popular playwright in Japan, where all of his works were converted into Japanese plays. He was humongous in India. He is the basic root of Bollywood, is Shakespearean drama, is these Shakespearean touring companies who would take Shakespeare plays and they would convert them into, there's no tradition of tragedy in Indian literary form, so they would convert them all into tragicomedies, and they would give them all happy endings, and then they would interpolate musical numbers and also scenes about the gods, sometimes gods from the Hindu pantheon, watching over the action, commenting on it. And sometimes they would take 7-8 hours.
I would love to see that.
I know, wouldn't it be amazing?
Maybe for 2 hours, but still, I would love to see it.
Yeah, I read a description of one that was performed at a Maharaja's wedding of, I think it was Cymbeline, and it was like 9 hours. It ended at about 4 in the morning. And they they were, you know, Shakespeare was taken on in these places very easily. He was a humongous hit in the West, during the Wild West. He was, you know, performed in places like Nevada City. Touring companies would come from Boston and they would leave with $60,000 in the 1850s. So, you know, he has been hugely popular everywhere.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Richard in Arlington. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I had seen a PBS special about Shakespeare a few years ago, and they mentioned that some of the sonnets that he had written were written, he had a dead son.
Yes.
And that, you know, you might read these sonnets, and it's more out of grief and love for his son than. And could you just talk about that, please?
Well, I mean, I think to me anyway, it would be a stretch to say that the sonnets are about his son, because his son died very young, and there's definite the beauty of the young boy, like the poems about the boy are told, you know, go and have sex so that your beauty won't be lost to the world, that you'll have offspring and that they will go on and be as beautiful as you are, I would find that I've never actually read that argument. That would seem pretty difficult to me. On the other hand, his son's name was Hamnet, and he wrote Hamlet right after Hamnet died. And to me, that play, and also his father died right before he wrote Hamlet, and to me, that play is absolutely charged with, I guess, this feeling like the men around you are dying. You know, like the connection between the past and the future has been broken through these catastrophes. It's a hard game pinning down how Shakespeare's biography fit into his work, partly because we know so little about it, and partly because, you know, these plays are very, very complicated, and the sonnets are very, very complicated and very stylized, so it's hard to know exactly how it fits. But I think Hamnet had a big effect on Shakespeare's writing, his death. My personal view is that right after Hamnet died, he just got really, really excellent. I mean, that's when he started writing Hamlet and Macbeth and Othello, and these great tragedies all followed right after his son's death. But I'm falling into the trap that everyone falls into, which is feeling like I know who he is, and nobody does.
Maybe that's the magic, too, is that we all think we know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because he's very moving, and you feel like you have a connection with this person. But who this person is actually very shadowy and very, very hard to know.
So I want to make sure we get to this because I promised it at the top of the hour. What does Shakespeare have to do with the proliferation of starlings all over North America?
You've got starlings there, right?
Like, we do. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the thing was that starlings were introduced into North America by a man named Eugene Shiflin. He introduced them into Central Park in New York in the 1890s, his plan was to introduce every bird mentioned in Shakespeare to North America. And, you know, he released a lot of things like European skylarks and so on that just died immediately. But the starlings took off, and now they're a huge crisis. I mean, they haven't even finished extending their range. They're still creeping north of the Atlantic Circle, and they're working their way down into Mexico, like into Central America. And they're incredibly destructive. I mean, some reports of ornithologists claim that, you know, if it weren't for starlings, places like Texas would be full of bluebirds, right? Fields of bluebirds. Instead, we have these nightmarish pests.
But it's not even like Shakespeare had a thing for starlings, right?
No, he mentioned them once. He mentioned them in one line of Henry IV, which is incredible to think. Like, if this was the kind of model for me for the whole book, because, you know, it's not like Shakespeare planned any of this to happen,
right?
You know, it's not like he thought, "Oh, Jessica, that'll be a good name for people to use 400 years from now." He just thought, you know, Iska is kind of ugly. Why don't I make it Jessica? And then it has this huge consequence down the road. It's the same here. Like, if he had not written that line, we would not have starlings in North America. So he has this huge power without any control over it, which I think is kind of what I think literature has. It has this huge amount of power, but no one really knows to what end.
Do you think, Stephen, that our reverence for Shakespeare runs the risk of keeping us from exploring other talented but less famous playwrights, even of his own era?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no question that it does. I mean, Christopher Marlowe.
Yeah, I've never been to a Marlowe play.
Right. I mean, and they're unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dr. Faustus. Have you been to a John Webster play?
No.
Well, I mean, he only wrote two plays, and they're the best. I mean, The Duchess of Malfi and The White Devil, they're these unbelievably great plays. And then there's all sorts of other minor playwrights at the time who wrote, maybe not, you know, works as comparable to Shakespeare, whereas Marlowe and Webster definitely are in that league. But, you know, Thomas Middleton, who wrote a bunch of amazing, amazing plays, they were only recently put into proper scholarly editions, you know? I mean, 5 years ago, I think, they were finally put into proper scholarly editions. So Shakespeare does take up all the air in the room, for sure.
So will there ever be another author, another artist with this kind of reach? I realize we can't say that for another 400 years, but do you think it's even possible with the way the world works now?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's possible. I mean, you know, I guess anything's possible. I mean, that's a short answer. But, you know, I think Homer was considered hugely influential. And in Shakespeare's time, no one would have thought, oh, this guy writing these little plays that get put on for 9 days around the whorehouse district. He's going to live forever. No, Homer's going to live forever. Yeah. But, you know, I don't think, I mean, the thing about writing is it's totally unpredictable.
Yeah.
And I would say the same is true for history, too. A lot of accidents went into the making of Shakespeare as a huge figure.
How did your students, when you were teaching, respond to sort of starting a lesson with stories like these?
Well, you know, I always found that teaching Shakespeare was the easiest gig that you could have because they really work. I mean, they work for everybody. You know, it's not like if you teach someone like, Kafka. You know, I mean, he's a genius and so on, but some people are going to get it, some people aren't going to get it, you know. I mean, if people don't get Macbeth, they're probably not going to get any work of literature, period, right? I mean, if they don't find that interesting, then, you know, they're probably not going to find much that writing can offer very interesting. So I just found it, I mean, they were interested in it, although, you know, I think they were more interested in the plays. You know, the when you first experience these plays, they are very fascinating. And you know, I had great students when I was at City College. But I found that getting them to care about the plays was actually pretty easy.
The new book by Stephen Marsh, out now in paperback, is called How Shakespeare Changed Everything. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Total pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.